Okay, it's December 8th. I hope to wrap up tonight and next week. Well, I was running out of time. I don't particularly want to run into the 22nd of December, getting a little close to Christmas. So I'll see if I can bring this into the 20th century and into the 21st century, cover the remaining topics. Okay, so you should have a handout called The Creation of Today's Middle East. So we'll look at what happens in the 20th century and the 21st century. Then next week, move on, look at the... So tonight will be primarily how the different countries came about, and then next week we'll look at the various religious groups. Let's pray. Lord our God, as we look around the world and we see much confusion, and that is certainly true of looking at the Middle East and seeing these countries and the great confusion that there's been throughout the 20th century and into today, and the rise of rulers and the fall of rulers. Yet we read in the scriptures that you are sovereign over them all, you superintend all things, and that you know all that goes on in the Middle East, that nothing takes you by surprise of what happens there. As we look at the rising and falling fortunes of various empires, we're reminded that throughout scripture, empires rose and empires fall, and you pursue your purposes. And think particularly of that, this season of Advent, that in the midst of the tyranny of the Roman Empire, that you quietly sent your Son to earth to establish a kingship that would never fail. It would go from strength to strength till the knowledge of you covers the seas, fills the earth as the waters cover the seas. Thank you for that confidence we can have in your ultimate sovereignty and the ultimate success of your plans amidst all the vicissitudes of human empires. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, 2 weeks ago, I covered the rise of the Ottoman Empire. It reached its almost its greatest extent under Suleiman the Magnificent. Among other things, he captured Baghdad. He built the walls around the old city of Jerusalem that still stand today. He besieged Vienna and rightly is called Suleiman the Magnificent. The first 7 or 8 rulers of the Ottoman Empire were very good rulers, and after Suleiman, the empire went into rather a decline, had a whole string of rather inferior rulers. There was a last-gasp effort to regain some glory, 1683, once again besieged Vienna, failed in that as they had back in the 16th century, and thereafter the Ottoman Empire went into decline. By the middle of the 19th century, it was called the sick man of Europe, and in the early 19th century, it began to lose bits and pieces of its territory, beginning with Greece in 1830. I found this map that shows the growth of the Ottoman Empire. I couldn't find a map that shows the decline, the pieces that got nibbled away. Here's how Greece got built. So 1821, a war of independence broke out. That carried on to 1832, but in 1830, Greece won its independence. This much of it, so the Peloponnese, the main portion here, and then these islands here. And then over the course of the next 100 years, it gradually acquired more and more pieces of territory until the last bits of it weren't acquired until 1947. But we'll come on to those. Now, at one point, look at this bit here, ceded by the Treaty of Sèvres. We're going to come to this. In the aftermath of the First World War, Greece was awarded this piece of territory and this piece of territory here, which they subsequently lost in 1923. These islands here, the Dodecanese, were ceded by Italy in 1947. Italy took them in 1912. We'll cover that in a bit. Finally, Greece got assembled into the country that it is today by 1947. But 1830 was the beginning of the unraveling of the Ottoman Empire as it lost its territory. The next major piece to go was Egypt. In 1869, the Suez Canal was built. That was very crucial for Britain because it gave them a faster route to India, the jewel in the crown. So Britain understandably had a vested interest in maintaining the security of that. And they used that as a pretense in 1882 to essentially invade Egypt and the Sudan. And they established what was called the Khedivate of Egypt, which was, and it was a bizarre situation for the next 30 years, because nominally Egypt was a province of the Ottoman Empire, but the British had complete control over it, and there was nothing the Ottomans could do about it. That was a sign of the weakness of the Ottomans. Then the British extended their control down to the Sudan. So de jure, in international law, would have been part of the Ottoman Empire. De facto, it was completely British, under British control. The Sudanese didn't take too kindly to that, and a religious leader there set himself up, proclaimed himself as the Mahdi. So that's one of the branches of the Shiite movement that looks forward to the coming of the Mahdi. So he claimed that he was the Mahdi and succeeded in defeating the British, drove them out of, he had the fall of Khartoum and the death of General Gordon. Gordon of Khartoum, which for me, growing up with British history, is one of those tragic stories we learned about, the heroic figure of Gordon of Khartoum, who distinguished himself in China. He's the Gordon of Gordon's Calvary in Jerusalem. If you've, those of you who've been to the Holy Land and seen the near the bus station on the north side of the north of the Damascus Gate, this hill that looks like a skull, that's the Gordon. He's the man who claimed that that might be a site for Calvary. Close by is the Garden Tomb, which is not the real tomb, and Gordon's Calvary is not the real Calvary. But there were particular reasons why he said it was, and for the knowledge at the time, it was not too unreasonable a claim. Kitchener then reestablished control of this, British control of the Sudan, and up until the 1950s, it was then governed as Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, as this condominium of British and Egyptian rule over the Sudan, but with a British in control. When it comes to Egypt, jumping ahead a little bit, 1914, when the Ottomans joined the First World War, Britain just out and out declared independent protectorate of Egypt, and then they got a king, King Fuad. And it was there was the rule by the king up until the coup that put Nasser in power, and it became a republic. That was in the early 50s. 1956, it was the Suez Crisis with the British and the French and the Israelis trying to take control of the Suez Canal again. The Egyptians sort of came out of that, the winners. Trying to protect British interests caused Britain to get into some long-term intervention in that region. But the Ottomans sort of lost Egypt in 1882, officially still theirs, but they had absolutely zero control over it from 1882 onwards. The next piece of territory to go was in 1912. The Italians took Libya. I put down there it was the Vilayet of Tripolitania. Well, the Vilayet is that's the title, the name of the provinces that the Ottomans divided their empire up into large provinces. And the Italians also took the Dodecanese Islands. Now, Libya is close to Italy. It's immediately south of Italy. But why would they take the Dodecanese Islands? These islands are a long way away from Italy. Italy was trying to create an empire. Right. So the British had an empire, and the French had an empire, and the Italians were feeling a bit left out. So they wanted their empire, so they started with Libya. Then they took the Dodecanese, and then they went off to take Abyssinia. And the Dodecanese here, a treaty was signed in 1912 to end the war, and the Italians were told to give those islands back to the Ottomans, and they just quietly ignored that and carried on occupying them. 1923, in the Treaty of Lausanne, Turkey, and by then the Ottoman Empire had become Turkey, relinquished its claim to those islands. So the Italians continued to be there, and they were there all the way through the Second World War and didn't finally let go of them until the peace negotiations after the Second World War. But it meant that for 35 years, those islands were under Italian rule, And the Italians tried to make the people there, and the people living there were Greek Orthodox. They tried to make them all into Italian-speaking Catholics. There's still a lot of hard feeling on the islands. 10 years ago, Sue and I spent two weeks in Patmos in the off-season, and we came across a little bit of this, and just reading it was evident. There's still hard feeling there, this bitter taste in the mouth from the Italian efforts to make them into Italian-speaking Catholics. And there's a fair bit of Italian architecture in, Patmos. And then in June this year, we were in Rhodes. Rhodes has the town of Rhodes has a beautiful crusader. Well, much of it is preserved as a crusader, old crusader town. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And in the center of it is a castle. And Mussolini spent considerable amounts of money restoring that castle so that he could use it as his palace, as Il Duce. So that's why the Italians were there. They had taken control of it to try and build their empire and refused to give it back. Then in 1913, there was a war in the Balkans. So the country, the portion up here, looked at the Italians and said, well, if they can get captured territory, we can strive for our independence. And so more of it broke up. So as the First World War broke out, the Ottoman Empire was unraveling, which brings us into World War I. And World War I is very important because the configuration of the Middle East today is largely the result, not so much of World War I, but of the peace treaties that happened to settle World War I. The Middle East is still sort of paying the price for that today. So World War I was between two sets of powers, the Central Powers and the Allied Powers. The Central Powers were initially Germany and Austria-Hungary there, and they had entered into an alliance in 1879. So when Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated down in Sarajevo, he was of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and then Germany, because of its alliance, had to respond, or had to join Austria-Hungary in that. After the war broke out, the Ottoman Empire, having initially dallied a bit as to which side to join, they joined in on the German side and then Bulgaria. So that ended up being the Central Powers. So two massive powers, Austria-Hungary and Germany, and then two small powers, Bulgaria and the Ottomans. It was a bit of a surprise that the Ottomans, given that they're the sick man of Europe, they were already they'd been the sick man of Europe for 70 years by this point, and it was assumed they couldn't fight at all. And to everybody's surprise, they actually did very well, notably at the Battle of Gallipoli in 1915. So the centenary of that is just a few months away. But that was because they had very good leadership. We'll see about that. On the other side, there was the Triple Entente, the UK, France, and Russia, and they had signed that Entente in 1907. After the war broke out, they were then joined by some other countries, Italy finally joined in, and Greece, and then the US joined in 1917. Greece in 1917 as well, and Italy, I think, 1915. But as you all know, the US didn't join in until pretty late into the war. The efforts to get some of these other countries to join in on the Allied side led to certain actions in the Middle East that had unfortunate consequences, let's say. Let's put it that way. Okay, after the World War I broke out, the British got themselves into a bit of a pickle. They made three sets of agreements that were mutually contradictory. First of all, in 1915, there was a correspondence between what's called the McMahon-Hussein correspondence between the British High Commissioner in Egypt. He was a very important person because Egypt was on the way to British India, and Egypt guarded the Suez Canal. And Egypt, 1914, the British had just gotten rid of this fiction of Egypt sort of being independent and had declared an out-and-out protectorate, British protectorate. So Henry MacMahon had a correspondence with the Sharif of the Hejaz. And the Hejaz is this region of Saudi Arabia. The chief city is Jeddah, but the notable feature of the Hejaz is that it contains Mecca and Medina, so the two most holy sites of Islam. And the Sharif is the title that's given to the ruler of that district, and therefore the one who ultimately has oversight of those holy sites. Now, the people of the Hejaz have always viewed themselves as distinct from this area of Saudi Arabia, well, what today we call Saudi Arabia, then just the Arabian Peninsula, notably the Nejd, which is this area in here, which is largely empty desert. But here they were at the Hejaz. It's a range of mountains running up here that sort of cuts it off from there. And their orientation is much more towards Africa. They speak a version of Egyptian, of Arabic that's closer to Egyptian Arabic. And they've got the seacoast and are distinct from the people of the interior of the peninsula. Anyway, the Sharif, Sharif Hussein, they had his correspondence, and MacMahon asked him to get the Arabs to revolt against the Ottoman Turks. And if they did that, if they successfully launched this Arab revolt on the side of the British against the Turks, then the British would grant them independence, give Arab independence. Now, what territory would they have independence of was a little bit ambiguous. It was assumed it would just be one single piece of territory. And the correspondence said that it ruled out one exception, one area that, in a sense, the Arabs would not get. And that's the territory up here, right along the what is today really the Lebanon coast and the Syrian coast. There's a string of four main cities from Aleppo through Homs and Damascus here, and that territory to the west of that, the Arabs would not have as part of an independent state. But it was assumed that everything else that where the Arabs were, they would have as a state over which they could rule. What was left ambiguous is if you draw this line down here, does this territory here fall to the west of that line? Is that line to run south all the way down to Amman, and therefore the territory here was excluded from that? And those who are observant will notice that that territory is Israel. Whether that was deliberately left vague or not, nobody quite knows, but it was a myth. So, this is the Arab revolt, and Hussein successfully launched the Arab revolt in mid-1916. And he declared the kingdom of Hejaz. He took the British at their word, and he proclaimed himself king of the Hejaz, this independent kingdom that lasted up until 1923, when the ruler of Nejd, one Ibn Saud, conquered the Hejaz, and went on to conquer the rest of other territories and established the kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Maybe I'll explore this more next week, but the people of the Hejaz have never taken too kindly to that. They were always distinct from the people of this empty interior, so potentially a bit of an uneasy alliance that the people of the Hejaz, with their independent identity, have been assumed into this larger kingdom of Saudi Arabia with its radical form of Islam, and that Saudi Arabia, or the House of Saud, is now the keeper of the holy sites of Mecca and Medina rather than the native people of the Hejaz. But that's another matter. So, back to 1915. So that's the first situation the British got themselves into. All right, so this promise to the Arabs of independence if they came out with the Arab revolt. So this is the revolt that's portrayed in Lawrence of Arabia. In the British office in Cairo, there were a number of leaders there who were what we call Arabists. They were fluent in Arabic. They were familiar with the situation in Arabia and generally wanted the Arabs to rise up in revolt. And some of them, including T.E. Lawrence, Again, he assumed that the British were making these negotiations in good faith. Now, how many of the people in Cairo, how far up the hierarchy that went in Cairo that they assumed that the British were negotiating in good faith? Not quite sure. Okay, second situation. In 1916, the Sykes-Picot Agreement was signed. And this was signed in secret. Mark Sykes and Francis Georges Picot were mid-level civil servants. They were not high-level civil servants. They were mid-level civil servants. Certainly Mark Sykes thought that he was accomplishing the wishes of the leadership in Cairo. But the two of them, and again, I mean, these were only mid-level people. They're not high-level people. But they came up, they decided, or they felt that they were instructed to divide up the northern Arab portion of the Ottoman Empire between the British and the French. This is a picture of the actual map that they drew their lines on. Blue is the area of complete, full French control. Red is the area of complete British control. They used red. I mean, at one point, 40% of the map was colored red. Right, for the British Empire. And then A and B are, A was the area of French influence and B was the area of British influence. And they just essentially drew this straight line on the map, demarcating the two. And then here, they separated out Palestine as being an international protectorate, essentially. So the French wanted what became Syria and the Lebanon, and the British wanted Mesopotamia, and then eventually they were to end up with Transjordan here. Here's somebody who's redrawn this to make it more clear. So the French would occupy this area, which included a good portion of what is today Turkey, this area of Cilicia. Zone A would be a protectorate, so it would nominally be independent, but under French protection, which really means French troops are there and they say what happens. The British would occupy this area of Mesopotamia and then would protect in quotation marks there, that. And then this would be an international zone here. And then the Russians would get this bit up here. So the Russians were in on the agreement as well. 1917, the Russian Revolution happened, and the Bolsheviks took over control, and they went through the archives, and they went through all the material that was there in the Foreign Office, and they found this agreement, and they publicized it. They didn't keep it secret. That caused considerable embarrassment, because the war wasn't yet over. The war still had another year to run, and the British and the French were rather embarrassed that it got revealed that they were making these secret agreements to carve up the Middle East between them. To carve up essentially the Arab portions, especially since the British had made this agreement with the Arabs, right? That they were going to give, presumably, this territory here to the Arabs. Now, this line here essentially marks that line from Aleppo down to Damascus. And the area west of that is what the even Mukmahon said they wanted to keep for themselves, or the Allies keep for themselves. So that's the second thing that the British, the agreement the British made, but in connivance with the French. And that, too, comes out sort of towards the end of the Sykes-Picot, of the Lawrence of Arabia movie, right? It gets mentioned. And then the third thing, 1917, the Balfour Declaration. Lord Balfour was the British Foreign Secretary, and he sent a letter to Lord Rothschild, acting as representative of the Jews, and said, I put the text on there. I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the cabinet. And here's the declaration. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. It's a little bit ambiguous, a number of things. The establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. So first of all, what is Palestine? Secondly, does in Palestine mean all of Palestine or a portion of Palestine? The exact boundaries of it or exact, what constitutes Palestine and what constitutes in Palestine are left undefined. And then note at the end that it says this is all to be done without A, prejudicing the rights of non-Jewish communities there, and without prejudicing, without influencing or affecting the rights and political status of Jews in any other country. So the creation of any Jewish homeland there shouldn't impact Jews elsewhere. This has caused all sorts of problems and continues to cause problems. It continues to be widely quoted, and Jews today, the ones who want to deny Palestinians to have any portion of the territory, will quote the Balfour Declaration. And the more extreme of them will interpret this as intending that the entirety of Palestine was intended to be the Jewish homeland. What's the entirety of Palestine? Well, in 1921, Britain will be granted a mandate by the League of Nations for Palestine. And that includes the entirety of Jordan, what is today Jordan. And the more radical of the Jews in Israel, who are calling for a greater Israel, want at least the east bank of the Jordan and preferably the entirety of Jordan. The more moderate ones say, well, Jordan is already a Palestinian state, and all the Palestinians should just move there. And then the more moderate ones are willing to allow some sort of a Palestinian state in the West Bank, all coming out of this letter. And then the ones who are calling for a greater Israel conveniently forget that the Balfour Declaration gave this caveat that there should be nothing should prejudice the rights of the people who live there. And then certain groups in Israel say that they are the state for all Jews, and basically that then prejudices the political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country, because it's saying, essentially, you really belong to Israel, and you don't really belong to other countries. So this letter has created a lot of mischief. 1917, so in just over 2 years, it'll be the 100th anniversary of it. I know preparations are underway in various ways in the UK to try and mark this, and the people calling for Britain to try and undo, that Britain has at least a certain moral responsibility to try and do what it can to rectify the damage caused by this letter. Well, why did Balfour issue this declaration? Why did the British cabinet agree to it? It's really become clear now that they primarily did it in order, they were trying to get the US to join the war, come in on the side of the Allies. Woodrow Wilson's two chief advisors at the time were Louis Brandeis, who was on the Supreme Court, after whom Brandeis University is named, and then Furtwängler. So both of them were Jews. The British basically issued this declaration to encourage the Zionists. Both Brandeis and Furtwängler were Zionists, namely they were advocating for Jewish return to Palestine. And there'd already been a significant return of Jews there. And the Zionist movement by this point really had started in 1881, so is 35 plus years old, to issue this pro-Zionist statement so that Brandeis and Furtwängler would then be encouraged and then be able to persuade Wilson to enter the war. But the upshot of this is that Britain got caught in this situation. It's got these three undertakings that it's three directions that it has undertaken to go after World War I. To give the Arabs independence, to carve up the Middle East with the French, and to give the Jews a homeland. Okay, World War I ended. Well, the Americans did finally enter in 1917. The war ended the next year. The armistice was signed on November the 11th. At 11 a.m. came into effect, which the world still remembers, still pauses for. And then the peace negotiations took several years. and have left ruins, let's say. Peace negotiations at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 was conducted really by these four men, who pretty much single-handedly, between the four of them, they met dozens and dozens of times and negotiated everything. So David Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, on the left. Next to him is Vittorio Orlando, is the Italian Prime Minister. Georges Clemenceau, the French Prime Minister. And then Woodrow Wilson, the U.S. President. They had conflicting agendas, right? So Lloyd George was still living in the days of colonialism and wanted to preserve the route to India. So he wanted to ensure that the British had control over the Suez Canal and had a secure passage through to India. And that's why the British were interested in Mesopotamia, because it too was on the way to India. Italy was a latecomer to the colonialist game, and it was still trying to get in on the act. It was trying to build its colonial empire. The French had colonies, and they were wanted to expand their empire, and they wanted to get Syria. And then Woodrow Wilson wanted to dismantle the whole colonial enterprise, and he'd come up with his principles of self-governance, that the people of a country ought to be the ones to govern it. But he was hampered by the fact that the U.S. was essentially non-interventionist and didn't want to get itself involved in the rest of the world. So he had these wonderful principles, but no mechanism for actually bringing them about, and a country back home that was not at all interested in doing anything to bring this about. Well, they negotiated a number of things that came about as a result of the Paris Peace Conference. The first was the League of Nations was created. So recognition that nations needed to join together to try and create more harmonious situations. Then they prepared five peace treaties that would end the state of war. Unfortunately, these peace treaties were punitive. So first of all, the Treaty of Versailles, that's the most famous of them, signed in June of 1919. This is the one with Germany. Germany was forced to sign this. Germany was forced to take full blame for the war, to pay massive reparations, to disarm, and to surrender territory. So it was a punitive treaty, and it was so harsh that the harshness of the treaty is viewed as a major reason for the rise of Nazism. Right? So the Nazi Party, one of their agendas was to restore national pride in Germany after the humiliation of, not so much the humiliation of losing the war, but the humiliation of the terms of the Treaty of Versailles. So it's because of that that, I mean, World War I was often called the war to end all wars, and the peace treaties afterwards are then called the peace to end all peace. because, unfortunately, the peace treaties were such that they pretty much guaranteed war. I mean, they failed to establish a real peace. Now, after the Second World War, the attitude was completely different. The U.S. undertook to rebuild its former enemies, right? The countries of Western Europe weren't, the victorious countries of Western Europe, the countries of Western Europe that were on the winning side, were in no position to help rebuild. For them, it was a Pyrrhic victory. They won the war, but they were devastated as a result. But the U.S. was. The U.S. came through with a roaring economy, and then rather than impose punitive sanctions on Japan and Germany, set about rebuilding them. So you had a much more enlightened generation of victors in MacArthur and Eisenhower, and you had the Marshall Plan and things like that. Yes, the Americans occupied Japan the British, the French, and the Americans occupied West Germany, but it was essentially an enlightened occupation that led to the rebuilding. And the result was Germany and Japan eventually emerged as far stronger than Britain and France, the supposed victorious foes. It then meant that earlier this year, the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I, the British and the French, the French and the Germans met first in Alsace, as these people had been at enmity for a long, long time. But because of the rebuilding that went on after the Second World War, they were able to come out of that no longer as enemies, but actually as friends together once the Treaty of Rome got signed and the common market got going, and have been able to live in friendship for 60 years. They wouldn't have gotten together after the First World War, and that left them as enemies. Okay, so the Treaty of Versailles, then the Treaty of Saint-Germain with Austria, the Treaty of Neuilly with Bulgaria, the Treaty of Trianon with Hungary. Don't really need really to pay any attention to them. And then the Treaty of Sèvres. So the Allies met at the San Remo Conference in 1920, San Remo in Italy. So under the Sykes-Picot Act, the British and the French had already carved up the Arab part of the Ottoman Empire among themselves. And at the Treaty of San Remo, the Allies decided that they should carve up the Turkish part of the Ottoman Empire themselves. This is what they forced the Ottoman Turks to sign. This down here shows what the Sykes-Picot agreement would be, that the French would have Syria, the British would have Mesopotamia, what would eventually become Iraq. The French, you may recognize this rough shape here from the Sykes-Picot Treaty, the French would have this, which is Cilicia. They would have that for their empire. The Italians were given this territory here. And initially, that included this portion over here. And this was sort of their reward for entering into the war. The British kept for themselves Istanbul, what was called the, I want to say Straits Settlement, but that's Malaysia. But it's something similar to that, territory of the Strait or something. But it guarded the Dardanelles here. The British particularly wanted that. They were smarting over Gallipoli, and they were smarting over the loss of various warships there. This is actually Winston Churchill was the First Lord of the Admiralty at that point. He was the one in charge, well, who had to deal with the loss of those warships. So the British took that, and it was also partly to keep the French, the Russians out. The British were very concerned about that, keep the Russians out. Eventually, they agreed to cede this territory to Greece. That's another matter coming up. And then they did graciously leave the Ottoman Turks a little piece of territory there. Right? Remember back to how vast the Ottoman Empire was. That's what was going to be left of it after the Treaty of Sèvres. The Allies forced the Ottoman Turks to sign this, and the Ottomans were in no position to argue. They really had no power left and had to sign away most of their remaining empire. So this treaty was actually, the Treaty of Versailles was punitive and humiliating on the Germans. The Treaty of Sèvres was even more punitive and even more humiliating to the Ottoman Turks and far more devastating. But it was duly signed in 1920. And then I put down there, it was revised with the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923, which was signed with Turkey, which did something completely different. But we'll come to that in a moment. And then other important thing that the Treaty of Paris Peace Conference did was it awarded German and Ottoman possessions as mandates. So the Germans had various territories, particularly down in Africa, German West Africa, Tanganyika, and a few other places that were under German control. They were then, and this was done under the League of Nations. So first of all, the League of Nations got established, and then the League of Nations awarded those territories to the British and the French and the Italians for them to run. So it was German possessions in Africa. There were some possessions in South America, and then the Ottoman possessions in the Arab, in their Arab world, which really meant sort of formalizing the Sykes-Picot agreement. And they followed, in awarding those mandates, they followed the lines that Sykes and Picot had drawn on that map that I showed you. So those territories were then stripped away from the Ottomans and given to the British and the French, not as colonies, but as mandated territory. And out of that was created the French Mandate of Syria, the British Mandate of Mesopotamia, and the British Mandate of Palestine. It was sort of like the British and the French were to run them on trust, as it were. It was recognized that they weren't ready for independence, but the Ottomans had to surrender them because they lost the war. They couldn't be independent. So they were given to the British and the French to run, and the British and the French were still thinking in colonial terms and still thinking that, well, of course we should run them. That sort of this colonial attitude. Okay, that brings us up to what happened in this piece of territory here and what finally brought an end to the Ottoman Empire. Any questions up to this point before we launch into the final death? Yes.
That Kingdom of Hejaz, which is on western Arabian Peninsula, and was supposed to stretch up here east of Lake Jordan, what happened to that in this time frame?
Well, it carried on as an independent kingdom until 1923, so it actually wasn't covered in any of the agreements of the Paris Peace Council. They dealt just with, essentially, with from here north. Kingdom of Hejaz was allowed to continue on until 1923, when the House of Saud, Ibn Saud, the House of Saud conquered the Hejaz, set up the Kingdom of Hejaz and Nejd, and then they went on and conquered this territory here and this territory down in the south here. And 1932, I think it was, they declared the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and it's what we have today.
Okay, so is it all essentially south of what the British and French had?
Yeah, and the British weren't really interested in anything down here. Had they known so much oil was going to be found there, they would have certainly wanted it. But it was mostly, this is all empty. There's nobody there. The British were happy for this to be a kingdom because it was essentially the people in Cairo who had made these promises concerning the Arab revolt who were happy for this to be an independent kingdom as a way of rewarding Hussein for coming in on the revolt. Yes, Lois.
Then when was the Kingdom of Jordan formed?
We'll get to that. We'll get to that after the break. Yeah, when we look at what happened with these mandates. That.
So tell us a little bit about this mandate. How is it? Is it just like another country? Or do they pay close attention to it or not?
We'll cover the mandate. We'll devote much more time to that. Okay, well, since now I've twice said we'll cover that in the mandate, so is your question concerning what we've already covered, Joseph?
There's a country, Armenia, right?
Yes, and then, right, the Armenians were to be given then their own territory back again. Now, this treaty was signed, but within a couple of years it got abrogated, so it never went into effect, because of something else that happened, which is what we'll cover immediately after the break. So I should let you take a break, mainly because what we'll next launch into will take probably 20 minutes, and that will make it postpone the break too long. So why did the Treaty of Sèvres, why did the Turkish part of the Ottoman Empire not actually get carved up this way? Italian troops did come in and occupy this area here, and the French were here, but the treaty didn't last very long because of what the Greeks did. So this is a map that I found that shows where the Greeks were at the end of the First World War. So obviously the Greeks were in Greece, but there were a lot of them here on the west coast of Anatolia. Then conversely, there were Muslims, Turks, over here in the northern part of Greece. And you see how they're all mingled in. And this west coast of Anatolia, there have been Greeks there for 3,000 years, right? So Troy is up here. At about 1,000 BC, Ionians established a series of colonies down this coast from Troy, Smyrna, Ephesus, Miletus, and all these. And they flourished as Greek cities for a long time. And during all the time of the Ottoman Empire, lots of Greek speakers lived here. They, by then, would have viewed themselves, they were sort of the remnants of the Byzantine Empire. They practiced Greek Orthodoxy. In their villages, they had churches, they had their priests, and they lived intermingled with the Ottoman Turks, who were Muslim. Greece had become independent in 1830, but the Greek prime minister at the Paris Peace Conference had visions of Greater Greece, Magna Graecia. So this is the map that he took with him. This is, as you see, from the New York Times, 1919. This is his map that he brought along to the Paris Peace Conference to say, this is what I want. He wanted Greece to be awarded all the coastline of Anatolia all the way around on the south side of the Black Sea, where there were, indeed, lots of Greek people. Now, the problem down here was that in the Treaty of Sèvres, this area down here, the Allies had already promised to Italy. So there were some conflicting claims there. In 1919, he then, after the Paris Peace Conference was well underway, he sort of, the Greek forces landed here at Smyrna. Now, at the time, Smyrna was the largest Greek city in the world. It had a Greek population that was larger than that of Athens. Smyrna was probably 50% Turkish, 50% Greek. The Greek were all the merchants, the traders, and that. And he landed there ostensibly to protect the Greeks. The Greeks needed no protection. They'd lived in peace with the Turks for centuries and centuries. But really what he was doing was he was staking out his claim to this map. So he landed there. Initially, the Ottomans couldn't do anything about it. And then this shows the progress of the war. The Greek troops marched inland and were well on their way towards getting out here to Ankara. It was fairly easy going for them. But meanwhile, there was a Turkish officer, Mustafa Kemal, who had actually been born in Greece. He was born up in here, Saloniki, Thessalonica of the New Testament, and had distinguished himself at the Battle of Gallipoli. He was the general that led the Ottoman troops at the Battle of Gallipoli, and it was his leadership, really, as well as his leadership which inspired the Turks. He was a brilliant tactician, but also he was a very inspiring man, and he inspired the Turkish troops. And that's really why, well, apart from incompetence on the Allied side, which there certainly was, that was why the Turks won the Battle of Gallipoli. After the Treaty of Sèvres was signed, right, this treaty, he was just disgusted with the Ottoman Empire. So he and some of his colleagues set up a national council. Essentially, they set up an alternative government, and they retreated to Ankara here and made that their base with this separate government. He was then able to rally the troops, the Turkish troops, and they fought a decisive battle here in 1920 and were able to turn back the tide and drive the Greeks all the way back to Smyrna and then drive them out completely. And in the process of that, the city of Smyrna, a lot of it was burnt, a lot of Greek property was lost, and a lot of Greeks fled from Smyrna. He then proclaimed the Republic of Turkey, took the name Atatürk, which means father of the Turks, proclaimed Turkey as a secular, nominally Muslim, but it's a secular country. And he abolished a lot of the old images of the Ottoman Empire. He abolished the fez, He abolished the headscarf. He changed the script for writing from Arabic script to Western script. He adopted Western dress and proclaimed this Turkish Republic. And he is single-handedly the founder of modern Turkey, which is why you go to Turkey today, everywhere, you see pictures of Atatürk, statues of Atatürk, everywhere. Although today, Erdogan, the current president, is slowly but surely undoing those measures instituted by Atatürk. Not quite sure what Erdogan's end game is, but he's certainly rolling back the secular policies instituted by Atatürk. Another thing he did was the Ottoman rulers who had signed the Treaty of Sèvres, he stripped them of Turkish citizenship. That's how disgusted he was with them for signing that treaty. And then a new treaty got signed. Oh, so then he abrogated the Treaty of Sèvres, this treaty that carved up his empire, declared it null and void, so it was cancelled. And then they had new negotiations which led to the Treaty of Lausanne. A number of things happened as a result of that treaty. It officially brought an end to the war. It recognized the independence of Turkey within these borders, right? So the Allies abandoned their idea of carving Turkey up, of the Ottoman Empire up into these other zones. Turkey relinquished its claims to the remainder of the Ottoman Empire, which included the Arab portions down here, but also it included Cyprus. Now, Cyprus had been occupied by the British already for quite a while, and they had annexed it with the outbreak of the First World War. And then the British continued to have Cyprus for decades thereafter. They finally officially relinquished their claim to Egypt and Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, which the British had had since 1882. So that just sort of formalized a state of affairs that had been there for a long time. And it guaranteed protection of the Greek Orthodox minority in Turkey and the Muslim minority in Greece. But as I put here, that was too late. Too late because in the meantime, in the month or two, after the signing of the treaty and before it could really go into effect, something else much more tragic had happened. I should say also, Atatürk abolished the office of, when he proclaimed the republic, the sultanate, the Ottoman sultanate came to an end, and he abolished the office of caliph. The caliph is the successor of Muhammad, and the caliph is the ruler of the head of the Islamic world. So that's what I referenced yesterday in my message. So that was abolished in 1924, and there has been no caliph up until Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi proclaiming himself the caliph in June this year. But the Ottoman sultans had been held the caliphate for 400 years. What happened before the treaty could fully go into effect was that in August of 1923, so the month after the Treaty of Lausanne, an agreement was signed between the Turks and the Greeks, the Convention Concerning the Exchange of Greek and Turkish Populations. This ordered the simultaneous exchange of populations that all the Greeks living within the territory that the Treaty of Lausanne had declared to be Turkey were forced to leave. They were expelled and had to go to Greece. And then all the Muslims or the Turks living in Greece were expelled and forced to go to Turkey. And that meant somewhere between 1 and 1.5 million Greeks driven out of Turkey and 400,000 to 500,000 Turks driven out of Greece. You were judged Greek or Turkish, not according to what language you spoke, but according to what religion you were. So if you were in Greece and you spoke Greek, but you went to the local mosque, then you were ruled to be Turkish and you had to go to Turkey. even if you'd been living there in Greece for your family being there for centuries, living alongside the Christians. Likewise, if you were in Turkey, in this new country of Turkey, and you spoke Turkish, but you went to the local Greek Orthodox church in your village, then you were ruled to be Greek, and you had to leave there, even though in their case, their families would have been there, your heritage might have been there for millennia, and you had to leave. And it was a time of immense hardship because they lost everything, both sides lost everything in that forced population exchange. Now, somehow I managed to go through my entire education never hearing about this. I heard about the population exchange in 1947 between India and Pakistan, but I'd never heard about this Turkish-Greek population exchange until I started leading tours to Turkey. And then in reading up about it, then find out that this is what had happened.
So why'd they do it?
That I still haven't fully established as to who the driving force was. I mean, ostensibly, it was to resolve the war, bring an end to this Greco-Turkish war that the Greeks had started. What I don't yet know, and I haven't read enough about yet, is to know, did the Western powers impose this on the two sides? Did Ataturk press for this? Did the Greeks press for this? Who was pressing for this to happen? So I don't yet know that.
So last week, the week before, you were talking about the millet system and the Ottoman Empire and how sort of there's sort of almost governments within nations.
Yeah.
I mean, it seemed like they basically were taking that millet system and actually using it as a reason to expel.
Well, I don't know if they were using it as a reason to expel. They used it as the guideline for who to expel. Yeah.
I mean, presumably by this time that whole system was dead, right? I mean, with the Ottoman Empire, is that true?
Well, the Ottoman Empire had only just died. The Ottoman Empire essentially died in 1923, and this agreement was in 1923. So basically, the Treaty of Lausanne, well, Ataturk proclaimed the Republic of Turkey, and then the Treaty of Lausanne in July 1923 formally recognized, internationally recognized Turkey within its borders, and then August 1923, the very next month, this agreement for the population exchange got signed. And then they decided who the populations were based upon that millet system. About 10 years ago, I read a historical novel that's based on this, Birds Without Wings, written by Louis de Bernier. He wrote Captain Corelli's Mandolin that got turned into a movie 10, 12 years ago. So it's a historical novel. I mean, it's based upon what happened. He describes life in a village down here, right about down here. So he describes, this is where the Italians were, so he describes the Italian troops who'd come in and had occupied the area. And he describes what life, as a historical fiction, but what life was like with the Greeks and the Turks, the Christians and the Muslims living side by side with their lives completely intertwined with each other, and then this ripping apart. The village he describes in there is actually based upon a real life village, this village here, Kayakoi, which Sue and I got to visit in June when we were there. The situation there had been that the Christians lived in this village up on the hill and the Muslims lived down on the valley floor. And the Muslims farmed the land on the valley floor and the Christians engaged in trade, and they were the merchants and the traders and so on. And the idea was that when the Turks were brought in from Greece, that they would settle in here, but they didn't want to live there. And they spread out, and eventually the Turkey removed all the roofs from the buildings, decided nobody was going to be there. But now, finally, they've actually turned this into an open-air museum, so they have now set about renovating it and preserving it, which... Yeah, I'm delighted to see the Turks do, that they are recognizing that this happened and are preserving the memory of that. Now, the one place that this did not apply to, Muslims up here, well, so it meant that Muslims got driven out of Salonika, right, the very place where Mustafa Kemal was born, Ataturk was born. lots of Turks up there, lots of Muslims up there. Muslims in the what became the Thrace, this is Thrace, region of Thrace. Part of it stayed with Turkey, part of it is in Greece. Muslims were allowed to stay there. So here in the far north, there are still a few Muslims in Greece. And then Christians were allowed to stay in Constantinople there. This shows what has happened to the population of the Christian population of Constantinople. Early 20th century, 30% of the city was Christian. Then after the population exchange, though Christians were allowed to stay, it declined to 15%. And then there have been a number of, in the 50s I think it was, there were riots and sacking of Christian properties. And the Christian population is now essentially down to zero. So one of the tragedies, one of the results of this is that Turkey got stripped of its entire Christian population. There is now a church in Turkey made up of Turks who are Muslim background believers. It's very small. It is growing. Estimates are that it numbers 8,000. Some of you have met Fikret Boçak, who's a Turkish pastor. When he became a believer, he said it was about 80. So there has been growth there. It's just a tragedy that because of that population exchange, the country was stripped of all of its Christians. Now, many of those would have been nominal Christians, but certainly in among them, there would have been faithful people, genuine believers. The ecumenical patriarch continues to be in Istanbul. So there are hardly any Christians left, but the ecumenical patriarch is still there. So it's not exactly 0%, but it means 0.0001% or something. There's just a handful of them operating out of the office of the ecumenical patriarch. This is the Greek Orthodox remnant. Then there'll be some Protestant, Western Christians there, expatriate Christians, and so on. 2 weeks ago, the Pope visited Turkey, and he met twice with the ecumenical patriarch. Remember 1054, the Great Schism, mutual excommunication of the leaders of the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church. So here is Francis seeking to mend that schism, and Bartholomew, the patriarch, welcoming him and blessing him and embracing him. But still, both sides there view themselves as the true church, so there's still an impediment, actually, any sort of reunification, as long as each of them insists that they're the true church and that the other one has to change, come to them. But this was a major progress to actually have Pope Francis go and do this. He also met with Erdogan. I don't know what he conveyed to Erdogan. Okay, so that's the situation in Turkey and Greece. That's why nowadays there are essentially no Christians in Turkey. So I should say, at the beginning of the 20th century, the Middle East was approximately 10% Christian. And in the Turkish part of the Ottoman Empire, that would have been higher. So substantial, very high, very significant number of Christians. The dhimmi system had been abolished in the 1850s, so there was no longer this discriminatory tax. They were no longer second-class citizens. They were under the millet system with their own leadership and flourished in many ways. So that's what happened in the Turkish portion of the Ottoman Empire and why there were no Christians left there, other than this renewed activity by Protestant missionaries to establish a church. Okay, any questions about that bit? Yes.
Armenia is Christian, right?
Armenia is Christian, yes.
At the same time, Armenian genocide.
1915 was the Armenian genocide. So Armenia was the first Christian nation in the world, remained Christian. The Turks, the Ottoman leadership during the First World War, was very worried that the Armenians would join with their fellow Christians, the Russians. And the Armenians sort of be this fifth column within their territory. And so that's the Turkish justification for why they acted against the Armenians. That certainly doesn't justify what they did. Turkey still officially still does not recognize the Armenian genocide. It's refused to admit it. It seemed to me that they've got a way out because Turkey today is not the Ottoman Empire. And after Ataturk declared the Ottoman Empire, he broke completely with the Ottomans. And so you could at least, well, just blame that upon those Ottomans who he had completely severed ties with, connections with as well. But no, this is a very highly, very sensitive subject in Turkey to raise the discussion of the Armenian genocide. And at the same time, there was a Circassian genocide. There was a genocide of various other peoples that were there at the meeting point of what today are Turkey, Iraq, and Iran. The Armenians bore the brunt of it, but there were other groups that went after. Yes, you were going to...
During deportations, did some people fall through the cracks, or like intermarriages, or they change religion?
I think this it was a thorough deportation. Yeah, I think it was very thorough. Million and a half on one side, half a million on the other side, almost 2 million people. It was thorough. So that's what happened in the Turkish part of the Ottoman Empire. Next, move on, look what happened in the Arab part, or the northern Arab part. So the League of Nations awarded mandates for these Arab territories to the British and the French for them to rule, well, to administer, let's say. That would be a better way of putting it. So the French, well, let's begin here with the British. So the British were given two mandates, the mandate of Palestine, and the boundaries essentially follow the lines that Sykes and Picot drew on their map in 1916. And they're lines in the sand. They're artificial borders. The British were given awarded the territory of Palestine, and the Balfour Declaration was incorporated into that. So the British were charged with administering this territory, including moving towards giving the Jews a homeland. The first thing the British did was they divided their territory in half. Well, two unequal halves. Down the Great Rift Valley, and the area on the east they declared to be Transjordan, so trans meaning across, so it's across the Jordan. And the area on this side, then they kept on calling it Palestine. Another word for it is Cisjordan, the Latin word cis, C-I-S, meaning this, so this side of the Jordan. That upset some of the Jews then and continues to upset Jews who advocate a greater Israel because they view this as an illegal act of the British to reduce the true dimensions of Palestine, which they then claim that the Balfour Declaration gives them the right to. Then the British set this up as an emirate, and they appointed a leader, an emir, a ruler. Now, they didn't pick somebody from within that territory. They went down to the Hejaz, and mindful of these promises that they'd given to Hussein, who the Sharif of Mecca, the Sharif of the Hejaz, who is now the king of the Hejaz, they fulfilled those promises by taking one of his sons, King Abdullah, and they made him the emir. So here you've got somebody now from Arabia ruling over the people there, of the land. That then was Transjordan. 1946, the British gave it independence, and the emir became the king. And then a couple of years later, 1948, the name of the country, now it's an independent country, officially became the Hashemite Kingdom of Transjordan. So Hashemite means that the ruler, the king, is from the Hashemite clan of Mecca. Now, if you remember back a few weeks, Muhammad was born into the Hashemite clan of the Quraysh tribe. So who's Hashemite there? Well, the only one person who's Hashemite there really is the king. The people aren't Hashemite. It's a Hashemite kingdom ruling over the people. So who are the people of Jordan? Well, some of them are Bedouin, the Bedou, the desert nomads. So again, think of Lawrence Arabia and the Bedou in their black tents moving around. So you still find them down here in Wadi Rum and places like that. And then the majority are Palestinians. So it's a delicate situation there that you have a royal family ruling over a people to whom it is not ethnically connected. And then the people themselves are divided into these two groups, the Bedou, who still are, I mean, they're country nomadic people, and the Palestinians, who are urban people. And that's caused tension back in 1970. A lot of Palestinians were driven out of Jordan. Jordan is often cited as being the stable country in the Middle East. Relative to the other countries, it is stable, but it's got these fundamental tensions in it because it's an artificial state. It's an artificial creation. Arbitrary lines drawn on a map, a king brought in from somewhere else and put over them. So it's fundamentally problematic. And Palestine, the British directly ruled that. So Transjordan, they ruled for the emir, and British influence remained strong, but it was semi-autonomous, you could say. The mandate of Palestine itself, the British ruled, and moved towards trying to figure out what to do with the Jews and the Arabs. So those of you who a few years ago took my class on Israel, the Church, and the Abrahamic Promises, I covered this in more detail in that, and I think also in talking to get ready for our trip to Israel in 2011. But basically, 1929, they had a Peel Commission. Well, no, 1929, the Arabs revolted about the growing Jewish presence. The British then set up a commission, the Peel Commission, which proposed dividing the land between the Jews and the Arabs. Well, after World War II, the British said that they were going to surrender their mandate and gave a date. Britain came out of the war in a bad condition and couldn't afford to run the place anymore. So they said they were going to abandon it. The UN proposed a partition plan, which got voted on in November 1947. The Jews accepted that partition plan. The Arabs refused to accept it. They really never were consulted on it and didn't see why they should surrender. The Jews at that point owned 5% of the land. They didn't see why they should surrender 55% of the land to these newcomers. And then 1948, May 15th, the State of Israel was declared. And there we are. Israel has never declared its borders. So there are no official borders of Israel. There is what was called the Green Line. That was the internationally recognized sort of armistice lines after the 1948 war. The peace lines with Syria and Jordan and Egypt and so on. But they're not actually borders. And on the map, the line between Israel and the West Bank that marked that armistice line, on the map it was drawn in green. That's why it's called the Green Line. Israel has essentially obliterated that green line and no longer even shows it on its maps. When I first went in 1994, all the maps still showed the green line. Modern Israeli maps don't. So that's one issue, very complicated issue, what to do with Israel. That's Transjordan. Number of things I'll talk about on this map. Britain also got awarded Mesopotamia as a mandate. That was this territory here. Well, no, let me first talk about Syria. Syria was awarded to the French, and that included Lebanon at the time. Prior to the Syrians taking over, there had been an Arab Congress in Damascus, the Syrian National Congress. This is also portrayed right at the end of Lawrence of Arabia. Fair bit of mythology in Lawrence of Arabia, but there's also, it's loosely based on facts. So there really was that Syrian National Congress. The Arabs essentially declared independence with a king. And who should they take as their king but King Faisal, who was the brother of Abdullah, who the British put over Transjordan. So another of Hussein's sons. And then the French came, they were assigned the mandate, and they got rid of King Faisal. He was too pro-Arab. He still had visions of what they were trying to put into effect in that council in Damascus was fulfill this promise that Macmahon had made of a greater Arabia, and it was assumed it would just be one country that would stretch all the way up the Arabian Peninsula, up through Jordan, up through Syria, and cover all the Arabic provinces of the Ottoman Empire. And it would be one country, and all the Arab-speaking peoples there. But the French didn't want that. They had been awarded this mandate, so they established the French mandate of Syria. They kicked Faisal out because he wasn't compliant to their wishes. And they ran that as their mandate. In the 1930s, this piece of territory up here became part of Turkey. So it was the area called Hatay. They held a plebiscite. Yes, there was a sizable Turkish population there, but if you look on a map, it really belongs with Syria. That's where Antakya is, Antioch of old, the third largest city in the Roman Empire. When I first went to Turkey in 2001, and again still in 2004, I had assumed Antioch was still in Syria. And I was surprised to find out in 2004 it's actually in Turkey, because Turkey has this little finger of land that extends down. So in 2006, I arranged that we went to Antakya to take a look at it. So it's certainly easier to get there with it being in Turkey than it being in Syria. Looking at a map, I say, well, it really belongs in Syria. Then the French granted independence in 1943, and they divided Syria into two countries. The part where there was a large Christian population, they turned into Lebanon and set up this complicated power-sharing agreement between the Christians, the Sunni, and the Shia. And the three top offices, so President, Prime Minister, and Speaker of the House, they awarded to one to each of the three religious communities. Initially, the Christians were in the majority. Their majority started to decline, and the Christians were, at least this is my interpretation, were getting uneasy about that. They tried to establish greater control, and that's really what sparked off the Lebanese Civil War. It was about this difficult, dangerous situation, or this fragile situation between the three religious communities that had managed to live at peace for quite a while, but the Christians were afraid that they were going to lose their majority. And they essentially made a power grab and threw the country into instability. And then Syria, it was a majority Muslim, but a large Christian population. I think I've mentioned this before, but up until very recently, even under President Assad, who's a dictator, he was a protector of the religious minorities. He was a religious minority himself, an Alawite, protected the Christian minorities, and so the Christians actually could flourish in Syria. We have somebody here at PBCC, a Christian who was born in Syria, Nora Kajarian, and then some of you know Nursus Balabanian, who's led worship for us. He's a pastor. He's Armenian as well. Both born in Aleppo up here. And one of the tragedies of the civil war is that the great losers there have been the Christians. Many of them have fled into Jordan and Lebanon, joining all the Iraqi Christians who have fled. Okay, so that's Syria. Next is Iraq. So the British were awarded the mandate of Mesopotamia, and they took three vilayets, three of these provinces of the Ottoman Empire. They joined them together. They drew a line around it and said, okay, that's now Mesopotamia. It's a mandate, so they're supposed to try and maintain this fiction of trying to nurture it along to be an independent country. So they went and got a king. Who should they pick up as their king but the king that the French had deposed, right? So imagine, he started out as king in Damascus, and then the British put him as king in Baghdad, King Faisal. So it carried on as a sort of a monarchy under British rule. The British then gave it independence, full independence in 1932 under his successor, King Faisal. Then 1958, there was a coup that overthrew the monarchy, and 1968, another coup, and the Ba'ath Party came to power. And in 1979, Saddam Hussein took over. There was for a while a foreign king, a king from Mecca, ruling over people to whom he really didn't have much connection, but got deposed. Iraq doesn't really belong together as a country. There's a Sunni region, the Shiites in the south, the Sunni in the middle, and the Kurds in the north. Saddam Hussein managed to hold them together in forced control, although he went after other groups. He was a Sunni, went after the other groups. After 1991, the British, the Allies imposed a no-fly zone up here in the north, which allowed the Kurds to flourish, and they've been doing very well. Saddam Hussein went after the people dwelling in the marshes down here, caused a tremendous amount of hardship. Hussein got removed from power, eventually got killed. The ruler there for the last years or so has been Maliki, who is a Shia. And he was supposed to have an inclusive government, include Sunnis in his government. He hasn't. He has discriminated heavily against the Sunnis, has been very pro-Shia. And as a Shia, he's allied himself with Iran. And that has led to the Sunni uprising of the likes of al-Baghdadi, who is a Sunni. He's now finally stepped down from power, but probably did so much damage. It remains to be seen whether it would be able to recover. Iraq used to have 2.5 million Christians. Most of them have fled. They fled to Syria, from where they had to flee again. They fled to Jordan and elsewhere. And there are few Christians left there, except up in the north in the Kurdish area. Okay, so that's how the Western powers carved up really what we would consider the heart of the Middle East. And the problem was the French and the British initially had no interest in, they wanted to have power, they wanted to control these areas. The British were driven by trying to preserve a safe line out to India. At that point, they were still trying to hold on to India, which eventually they did pull out of in 1947. But in the 20s, Britain still wanted to hold India. So along comes ISIS. They now have control over all this territory here, northeast Syria and northwest Iraq. They are no respecters of the border. So one of the first things they did when they spread from Syria over into Iraq was they bulldozed the border. Now, the border is just a line in the sand. Physically, it's an earth mound. So they bulldozed it. That's the shovel of a bulldozer there. And they said, publicly announced, that they were undoing the Sykes-Picot Act. They were undoing this great injustice from the past. They've awoken this memory of 98 years ago, this grievance, so that feeds the sense of grievance that there's this fundamental injustice was done by the Western powers in carving up the Middle East and in drawing these lines on a map. And that one of the things they're doing is writing that wrong. And this is one of the things that drives a fair bit of what happens in the Middle East is this historical memory and grievances. And the grievances are over things like the lost glory of the Muslim world back in its days when it flourished, this golden age, and wanting to recapture that. The humiliation of the Arabs and the Arab people after the World War I, and this carving up and wanting to undo that. And this then feeds people who are discontent, right? Young men. And there's a big problem of unemployment, youth unemployment in the Middle East. So young men who don't have a job, who don't have a career to look forward to, who don't have a trajectory in the life that they're moving forward, can latch onto these grievances and then go and join in this battle. And it's a potent sort of drug, really, to awaken their grievances. And then you get others who, the moderate Muslims and the moderate Arabs who are wanting to build a society and move forward and do that in conjunction with the West. And then the Christians are caught in the middle because with the radical Islamists, they view the Christians as being agents of the West. And the Christians who are as Arab as the Muslims are caught. And there's been this growing assumption that to be Arab means to be Muslim. Well, one of the people who really drove that was Nasser when he came to power in Egypt and overthrew the monarchy and really established Arab nationalism, and that Arab nationalism is equated with being Muslim, with the world of Islam, and the Christians started to suffer. Okay, If you're interested, I have a number of books that help. And this is a complicated history. One of the first books I read that helped unravel this is A Peace to End All Peace, right? Talking about the aftermath of the First World War by David Frumkin. Read that a couple of times. Lawrence in Arabia, this came out last year, not Lawrence of Arabia, but Lawrence in Arabia, and all the shenanigans that went on behind the scenes between the British and the French, some of which Lawrence knew about, many of which he didn't know about. And the subtitle, right, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. So it's the shape it is because of those things. And then one that came out this year, A Line in the Sand, The Anglo-French Struggle for the Middle East, and basically what impact Sykes and Picot drawing these straight lines on the map and carving up the Middle East, what impact that made. And that one I haven't yet read. Okay, any questions? Many questions.
Did you mention that the Palestinian and Jordan, they have a Bedouin?
Yeah.
And also maybe Hijaz, right? Are they all speaking Arabic?
Mm-hmm.
But do they belong to different ethnic groups? Or we just call them Arabic?
Well, the Bedouin, and there are Bedouin in Israel today, down in the south of Israel. They were essentially nomads, lived in tents, mobile people, moved around, kept flocks, followed their flocks around, speak Arabic, but are a rural nomadic people. The Palestinians simply means, initially, that you lived within the territory of Palestine. So you lived within this region here. So within that, there were Palestinian Jews and Palestinian Christians and Palestinian Muslims. And the idea of being a Palestinian Jew was not an oxymoron. Just like throughout the whole Ottoman Empire, there were Arab Muslims, Arab Christians, and Arab Jews. And an Arab Jew was not an oxymoron. And Arab Jews all spoke Arabic, and they'd all lived in these cities, towns that had Jews, Christians, and Muslims all living next door to each other, all speaking Arabic, all interrelated with each other's lives, all Arabs. So then the Palestinians be a subset of that. They're Arab, they're speaking Arabic, but religiously could be Muslim, Christian, or Jewish. Under the Ottoman Empire, they operated under that millet system. Even when Britain took over, they continued to be Palestinian Jews. And it's only more recently that then Palestinian has come to mean the non-Jewish people of this area, or then of the people who were driven out of that area in 1948.
So that means they are distinguished by location, not by the ethnic group.
Well, the Bedouin, and I would say they're also distinguished by culture. Palestinians and the Bedouin have a very different culture. The Palestinians lived in villages and towns and cities. They were a settled people. The Bedouin were a nomadic people. Now, certainly what's happened over the last 70 years is the Bedouin have settled down. Actually, in Israel, that's another issue, is getting the Bedouin to settle down. The Israelis are trying to confine the Bedouin to particular places. The Bedouin have their encampments that the Israelis keep bulldozing. That's another whole problem. So the two people, basically, it's the old urban-rural divide in the culture. The West Bank, between 1948 and 1967, was under Jordanian control, part of Jordan, and so there was a lot of movement of Palestinians living on the West Bank into Jordan, back and forth. They could freely move. Even today, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem is officially under Jordanian oversight, sort of left over from that. But the king is not of that people group, so if the Palestinians get too strong, and that's the problem there was back in the days of King Hussein, back in 1970, this rising Palestinian power that got too threatening for the king, and so he suppressed that. So all of which is to say, I mean, the situation in the Middle East is very complicated, and much of it was created by the Western European powers at the end of the First World War. Is this the final settling of all this, the consequences, the what now could be considered the unintended consequences, but I mean, was deliberate action of the British and the French at the end of World War I? Well, the British and the French, and then in particular areas, the Italians and the Greeks and so on, especially the British and the French, and that now that's all coming home to roost. Yeah. Johan.
It makes me ask the question, you ever imagine you back then in Sykes-Picot, what would you have done different?
Well, I don't know. I mean, presumably, if I was back then, I would have a colonial mentality. I mean, especially for me, I went through British boarding schools, and back in those days, the British boarding schools bred and educated people to go out and run the British colonies. So were I to have had that education, absolutely, I would have had a colonial mentality. And I grew up looking at maps that were colored red, 40% of the world in red, the British Empire.
Well, Woodrow Wilson or Roosevelt had a different model.
Wilson had a completely different idea, right. So he came up with this, he advanced this idea of self-determination. And he was alone among the Western leaders to have that. Problem was, for him, he behind him was a non-interventionist country that didn't want to get at all involved in the rest of the world. And so, yes, it was great for him to have these ideals, but he couldn't do anything to bring them about.
Do you think Karen King, Abdullah's wife, since she's Palestinian, is it a political marriage in some way?
I don't know. Queen Noor, that was Queen Noor was Hussein's wife.
Rania,
that's it. Yes, Rania, Queen Rania. Don't know.
So does it seem that at the end of the conflict, the biggest loser would be the original Palestinian, because the land is getting smaller and smaller, and then after 150 or 100 years, they don't have any place to settle. So there's they would be expected.
Certainly the Palestinians within that territory, this territory, the losers are the Palestinians. Throughout the whole Middle East, the big losers are the Christians. Within this territory alone, yes, the Palestinians in general have lost out. They're now confined to small portions of territory. But within that community that has lost out, the ones who've really lost out with it, then the Christians have doubly lost out. So within this, within the Palestinians living there, it used to be that 20% of them were Christians. And the Palestinian population is now down to 2%. The Christian population is now down to 2% of Palestinians. They have been leaving in large measure. They are the more highly educated, and it's easier for them to go and find jobs overseas and move and go to relatives. Now, a year ago, when I was at the this IFES conference for recent graduates, one of the great concerns of IFES was to encourage the Christians to stay. The Christian leaders are seriously concerned that the way things are going, there's going to be no Christians left in the Middle East. And there have been Christians there for 2,000 years, large Christian populations. And they're doing poorly in Syria and Iraq and all these countries under attack and pressure.
Do they still have a Jewish community in the Arabic world?
No. Well, there are tiny, tiny Jewish. Virtually all the Jews left, so not really any left. They left as a combination of with Israeli independence, there were some attacks on the Jews, but also Israel was encouraging the Jews to leave, because it wanted to increase the Jewish population, the Jewish percentage in its newly independent land. So it encouraged them to come. Okay, on the topic of IFES, I mentioned last week that the regional director for Intervarsity, this is IFES, International Fellowship of Evangelical Students, it's the global organization of which Intervarsity is. So he will be here next Saturday for lunch. I asked if anybody was interested last week in joining for that. So anybody interested in meeting him and having lunch with him? It's a very busy time of year. You may all very well be busy. Yeah, you're all busy. Right? That's fine. He's a Tunisian Christian. It's the first time that region has actually had an Arab as leader rather than a Westerner. There were 100 students there a year ago at this conference for 4 days, 5 nights, and it was just a fantastic time talking with them. Among other things, they talked about, do they consider themselves Arab? And they talked about, we had this big open session talking about this pressure, being Arab means being Muslim, and where do they fit as Christians in their various countries. Big session on the pressures to emigrate. Many of them owned up to the fact that they had thought about emigrating. IFES is trying to encourage them to stay as Christian presence there.
Where do they emigrate?
They come to the U.S. Plenty of Palestinian Christians here in the Bay Area. Lots go to Detroit. Very large Arab population there. Lots of Christians. A lot go to Australia. They go all over the world. Western countries. Okay, next week I will try and wrap up and look specifically at the religious communities and how they're all doing. Let's pray. Father, we thank you that you have kept your people there in the Middle East for 2,000 years. They have been there living under foreign rule of all sorts of different sorts who have continued to be Christian communities, followers of the Lord Jesus. And we pray that you would, those that are left, that you would sustain them, give them courage, give them hope, especially at this season of Advent. Assure them that you are with them, that you see them, that you are Emmanuel, present with your people. And I pray that you would grant courage and lay it upon the hearts of Christians to stay there, and that you would sustain them through the hardships and encourage them to continue to live in their lands as a Christian presence. Pray for those who are seeking to help going into those lands and help the Christians and help all the refugees, that you would sustain them as well. Father, we look at the great turmoil that has been there the last 100 years and the turmoil that goes on now, and I certainly don't know what any stable solution could be, but you are sovereign over that all, ruler over empires and kingdoms of all sorts of sizes. Pray that you would have your way with that region and that you would keep your people alive and sustain them, and that they would be shining lights in the midst of the great darkness, and that even in these difficult, difficult times, just as you grew your church in the days of the Roman Empire, and you would grow your church today. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.